Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, January 3rd, 2020 edition of the News Gazette. And we'll begin on the front page with a piece from Arcola High School called Back in Time. Purple Riders honoring Nifty 50s tonight, a special time in our lives. By Jim Rossow, Arcola. To look the part for tonight's throwback boys basketball game, Arcola High School athletic director Nick Lindsay scored a wool sports coat and corduroy pants at the Salvation Army store in Mattoon. "It looks top-notch," he said. "It'll be a little embarrassing, but I'm okay with that." Nancy Stiff Jim will take on a 1950s look tonight as a tribute to the history-making 1957-58 Purple Riders, Douglas County's version of Hoosiers. Like Lindsay, the coaching staff and their families will dress accordingly. "We want to get the tone," said Arcola's Greg Gissinger, whose wife and daughters agreed to ditch their usual attire. The players got their first look at their special order retro uniforms at Thursday's practice, where Gissinger might have fine-tuned a play similar to the picket fence to run against Tuscola. Junior varsity tip at 6 p.m., varsity at 7:30. "I can't divulge that," he said. The Rider Nation student cheering section will reward the best-dressed fan with $50. On display will be the sectional trophy won by the 58 team, which at the time became the smallest school to reach the Sweet 16 in the IHSA's one-class playoff system. Pat Monahan, 79, a senior on that 58 team, will address the crowd before the varsity game starts. Eight other players, managers, or cheerleaders have indicated they'll be in attendance too. "We were Arcola's first great team," Monahan said. "It was a special time in our lives. It was a big deal for the school and the community." And next we have a piece about legal marijuana around the area, Demand Still High in CU, by Deb Pressey, Champaign. At least 1,000 people were served at two dispensaries in Champaign-Urbana on the first day of legal marijuana sales, and customers continued to arrive by the hundreds on day two. Both Sunnyside Dispensary, Champaign, and NewMed Urbana opened Thursday at 6 a.m. for the second day in a row, and both had long lines of customers standing outside their doors in the afternoon. The line outside NewMed wrapped around two sides of the building, and Sunnyside's line stretched well into the parking lot. "It's been wonderful," said NewMed Urbana lead agent in charge, Sean Elber. Jason Erkes, that's E-R-K-E-S, maybe that's Erkes, a spokesman for Sunnyside owner Cresco Labs, said the dispensary in Champaign served just under 600 customers on New Year's Day, the first day Illinois began permitting adults to buy weed from licensed dispensaries for recreational use. "We're still going strong," Erkes said Thursday. NewMed Urbana served just under 500 people Wednesday, and by mid-afternoon Thursday had served another 400. "We'll probably beat yesterday," he predicted. One reason for that may be that medical marijuana patients, some of whom may have stayed away on the first day of recreational sales Wednesday, were returning to buy products on Thursday, Albert said. Despite the lines, police on site at the Urbana dispensary haven't had to deal with any misbehavior, Elber said. "Everybody seems to be pretty calm," he said. Statewide, dispensaries that opened for recreational sale on Wednesday together handled 77,128 transactions and racked up more than $3.1 million in sales, according to the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation. Cresco Labs' five Sunnyside dispensaries in Illinois together served 3,145 people and sold 9,258 cannabis products on day one, the company said. Both Urquis and Albert declined to disclose dollar figures for New Med Urbana and Sunnyside's opening day sales. The average ticket price per sale at all Sunnyside locations in Illinois Wednesday was $135, according to Cresco Labs. New Med wasn't making cannabis flower, which is smoked, available to recreational customers Wednesday or Thursday to prioritize its supply for medical marijuana patients, Albert said. Due to a statewide shortage of cannabis flower, he said he didn't know how soon New Med Urbana would begin selling it to recreational customers. Sunnyside still had cannabis flower available for recreational customers as of Thursday, but was continuing to limit the amount per sale of flower to 7 grams. Legalized weed sales aren't just earning money for dispensary owners. Both Champaign and Urbana approved a 3% sales tax on recreational marijuana. And next we have a piece about Maynard Bridgeford, UI's first archivist, Head Eye for Detail, by Julie Wirth, Urbana. When Maynard Bridgeford arrived on the scene, the history of the University of Illinois was scattered in boxes and files across campus. The UI's first archivist dug through 100 years of records to chronicle the university's past and make it available for future generations. Mr. Bridgeford, who died Saturday at age 93, essentially created the university archives and made it a destination for records from notable authors, scientists, and alumni. He was humble, but what he accomplished was really monumental, said current university archivist William Maher, who worked as Mr. Bridgeford's apprentice for 18 years. Mr. Bridgeford was hired as the UI's first full-time archivist in September 1963, a job he would hold for 32 years. Until that point, records were stored in attics and basements from Lincoln Hall to the UI Library to Turner Hall, Maher said. UI officials had made efforts to create a central repository around the school's 50th anniversary in 1917, but two world wars and the Depression delayed action for several decades, he said. In preparation for the UI centennial celebration in 1967, a campus committee decided to hire someone to do it. Bridgeford came with strong credentials, having worked at the Wisconsin State Historical Society and the state of Illinois. He was trained by Margaret Cross Norton, Illinois' first archivist, and a legend in the field. The Illinois State Archives building in Springfield is named in her honor, partially through Mr. Bridgeford's efforts, Maher said. With bare-bones support from the university, Mr. Bridgeford quickly created an easy-to-use archival system open to historians, researchers, and the public, Maher said. In the course of 2 or 3 years, he also landed several important collections, from the American Library Association, the Stuart S. Howe Collection on Fraternities and Sororities, and Avery Brundage, the influential and controversial president of the U.S. Olympic Committee, 1928 through 53, and the International Olympic Committee, 1952 through 72. Maynard saw that the scope of the archives needed to be more than records of university offices. It also needed to be records of prominent alumni who had significant careers, Maher said. Mr. Bridgeford negotiated a unique arrangement with the American Library Association, which agreed to pay the UI to hold its records and make them accessible to the public. Howe ran businesses that provided support services for student organizations and left his collection to the UI when he died, along with money to endow the Student Life and Culture Archives. Brundage, a UI track athlete who competed in the 1912 Olympics in Stockholm, kept meticulous records of his time heading the Olympic committees. Other institutions wanted the collection, and Brundage had his own ideas about creating a separate foundation, but he ultimately chose the UI. It's still used regularly for research on sports and politics and culture, Maher said. Mr. Bridgeford also set in motion the acquisition of papers from famed New York Times columnist and UI alumnus Scotty Reston, among others. And he established a systematic process for reviewing material to determine what's worth keeping for enduring value and what's not, Maher said. Archivists are primarily concerned with the future. That really was his vision, Maher said. The reason to keep this stuff isn't because it's old or pretty or cool. It's because somebody's going to want to use it to understand the past and survive the future. Mentor to many. Maher was a history student at Washington University when he became interested in archive work and asked a colleague where he should go to learn more. She relayed advice from her mentor, the archivist of the Smithsonian Institution. There's no one better than Maynard Bridgeford. Maher took a class with Mr. Bridgeford, enjoying his intellect, sharp observations, and dry sense of humor, and later took a job at the UI Archives. At that time, Mr. Bridgeford was reaching the peak of his career, leading the Society of American Archivists and bringing archives practices from Europe to his American colleagues, Maher said. He also served on national committees dealing with how to archive science and technology and computerize records into easily searchable databases. Mr. Bridgeford had a sharp eye for detail and an uncanny ability to pick up a 10-page report and immediately find a typo, Maher said. He could be a man of few words, especially when he was interviewed. You had to listen for the little things, the few words that he said when he was commenting on your work. There was a lot behind them, Maher said. In 2017, Mr. Bridgeford was recognized with the Chancellor's Medallion, along with Maher and Professor Winton Solberg, the UI's unofficial historian. Like any self-respecting archivist, Mr. Bridgeford was a collector of baseball cards, used books, and old maps, including an entire file drawer of superseded highway maps. He saw value in the past, Maher said. On his daily bike rides into work on his old Schwinn, Mr. Bridgeford would take note of every license plate he saw and add up those states' electoral votes, Maher said. Beloved Grand Dude. A native of northern Ohio, Mr. Bridgeford grew up listening to radio broadcasts of his beloved Cleveland Indians and remained a loyal fan. He later adopted the Chicago Cubs, unfailingly keeping score at every game, Maher said. He played softball as an adult and coached girls' teams for the Urbana Park District, where organized sports for girls were just beginning, said his daughter, Sarah Bridgeford. I will say that I enjoyed having an archivist for a father as we visited many historic sites on our family trips, as well as national parks and forests, she said. His grandchildren found him entertaining and called him Grand Dude. As a father and grandfather, he had a great tolerance for the chaos that comes with lively children, said his son, Charles Bridgeford. I can remember Christmases with 5, 6 or more grandchildren circulating from room to room in my parents' house in Urbana. Mr. Bridgeford always kept a diary and a few years ago shared the entries he made when he met his wife, Jane. It did not take him long to decide that she was the one, his son said. He attended Hiram College in northern Ohio, finishing his degree after serving in the Navy in World War II, and later earned a master's in history from the University of Wisconsin. He served on the board for the University YMCA, volunteered at the First United Methodist Church in Urbana, and delivered Meals on Wheels with his wife. And next we have a piece about an animal cruelty case, Woman Facing Charges for Ties to Horror Story, by Will Brumleave, Thawville. Last summer's discovery of hundreds of animal carcasses in shallow graves at a Thawville-based nonprofit animal sanctuary has led to its founder being charged with aggravated animal cruelty. newly unsealed Iroquois County Circuit Court records show that the Class 4 felony charge was filed against Corinne N. DiLorenzo, founder of the now-dissolved nonprofit Earth Advocates, also known as the Earth Animal Sanctuary. An Iroquois County grand jury had previously returned a one-count indictment against the 38-year-old Will County resident, alleging she intentionally caused the death of multiple companion animals, including dogs, cats, pigs, rabbits, birds, goats, raccoons, and turtles. According to the Will County Sheriff's Office, DiLorenzo was arrested on an Iroquois County warrant on December 24th and was released after posting 10% of her $10,000 bond. Her first court appearance is set for 9:30 a.m., January 23rd. An online petition demanding DiLorenzo be criminally charged was launched last summer, after the carcasses of hundreds of animals that had been rescued and surrendered to Earth Advocates were found at the sanctuary's property at 109 Southwest Park Street in Thawville. It was last June when Melissa Pena, a former board member for the Earth Animal Sanctuary, and two others visited the property, discovering nothing short of a horror story, Pena wrote on the sanctuary's Facebook page. There was an oblong-shaped ditch filled with bag upon bag upon bag of the remains of dead animals, Pena wrote. There were the remains of pigs that had been dragged out on a tarp or blanket and dumped in the hole. We saw skulls and bones of large pigs, medium-sized pigs, goats of various ages, cats, dogs, birds, waterfowl, and rabbits. There were small bags inside of larger garbage bags, as well as bags that contained multiple species of animals. We saw various states of decomposition. There were layers of animals, and after about an hour of ripping through bags with my hands, I couldn't do any more. I know that I have never thrown any of the animals I have ever loved in a ditch like they were trash, Pena added. Humane Care Citation. Even more carcasses were found in a follow-up visit. There were no live animals found on the property other than a couple of feral cats. To date, nearly 700 animals given to the sanctuary have been either found dead or are still missing, according to Jody Wiedercare, executive director of the Chicago Alliance for Animals. Following a suspicious fire at the property in September 2018, in which pigs, ducks, geese, and chickens perished, the Iroquois County Sheriff's Office began investigating complaints about the welfare of the hundreds of animals that had been rescued and brought up to the property, investigative reports show. DiLorenzo's ex-fiancé told investigators that about 6 months prior to the fire, the animals just started dying off for unknown reasons, according to a police report. While visiting the property, investigators found unsanitary conditions in DiLorenzo's home, where multiple animals were being kept, and ordered her to clean up and make various repairs to her home in order for her son to be able to return and live there. They also issued her a humane care citation after finding two malnourished pigs with skin issues believed to be caused by straw mites in an outbuilding. DiLorenzo denies claims. Wiedercare said she was pleased that Iroquois County State's Attorney Jim Devine found the animal cruelty case serious enough to charge DiLorenzo with a felony. Wiedercare said she hopes DiLorenzo is convicted and receives the maximum punishment allowable by law. Penalties range from probation to up to 3 years in prison. For as many animals that are missing and likely dead, she deserves more than a slap on the wrist, Wiedercare said. She deserves jail time, and she should never be allowed to ever own or be a guardian of an animal again. She should get the book thrown at her. DiLorenzo, who at one time worked as an independent AFLAC agent at the Abbey Insurance Agency in Buckley, told the Ford County Record last summer that the allegations of animal cruelty were unsubstantiated and slanderous. Attempts to reach her for the story were unsuccessful. And we'll turn now to the opinions page and begin with an editorial called Big Bucks Bloomberg. Easy come, easy go, but to what end? When business billionaire and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced his presidential campaign last month, he made it clear that the most formidable weapon in his campaign arsenal is his astounding personal wealth. Asked how much he is willing to spend, Bloomberg replied, "Whatever it takes." He's been as good as his word since then, spending money on campaign commercials in several primary states, including Illinois, at a record-setting pace. New accounts indicate that Bloomberg, a self-made success in the business world, already has spent $120 million. By early measurements, it hasn't gotten him very far in the campaign for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Other candidates, veteran politicos Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and others, are dominating the public opinion polls. But it's still early. Not a single primary vote has been cast. As the candidate field thins even further, there'll be more of an opportunity for Bloomberg's spending to have the desired impact. That, of course, raises the question, can money buy elections? The answer is a definite yes. But can it buy all elections? Will it buy the 2020 presidential election? The answers to those two questions are no and maybe. An ample campaign chest is a significant weapon, a reality that's been repeatedly acknowledged over the year in comments both humorous and flowery. For example, Ohio's Mark Hanna, a key leader of the Republican Party in the early 1900s, once quipped, "There are two things that are important in politics. The first is money, and I can't remember the second." California's Jesse Unruh, Speaker of the California State Assembly in the 1960s, reached poetic levels in his salute to the benefit of campaign cash, describing it as the mother's milk of politics. But it's not everything. California's Republican U.S. Representative Michael Huffington spent $28 million of his own money in 1994, at the time the most spent for a non-presidential campaign in American history. He lost to Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein. So far this year, another billionaire, Tom Steyer, has spent more than $80 million to win the Democratic presidential nomination. But the businessman hasn't even been able to make the debate field. Currently polling 0% nationally and just 2.5% and 3.7% in Iowa and New Hampshire, respectively, Steyer is definitely not getting his money's worth. Bloomberg isn't doing much better. He stands at 4.9% nationally in the Real Clear Politics average of public opinion polls. But his campaign spending cuts two ways. As Bloomberg hopes it plays out, his ads that both introduce him and attack President Trump are helping him and hurting Trump. If he can't kill two birds with one stone, one just might do him. Speculation, of course, runs amok as the political year advances. But it positively gushes in the early stages because there are few concrete facts, like election results, that contradict the speculation. That makes the question about the impact of Bloomberg's money irresistible now, even though the answers won't be forthcoming for months. And we'll turn now to the opinions page, and we'll begin with a piece written by Martha Yackel of Arthur called "Pelosi is One Who's Obstructing." I write regarding the editorial cartoon in the December 28th paper. We're supposed to believe that the House is the strong one when its case against President Trump is based on a highly discredited dossier and a bogus FISA warrant. None of the witnesses the Democrats brought forward in their partisan trial in the House could name one impeachable offense that President Trump committed. The one fact-based witness, he being the only one who actually talked to the president, even admitted that the president had said he wanted no quid pro quo. The others all gave their opinions based on their dislike for Trump. It's hard to believe that Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are operating from a position of strength when the charges they finally brought were so weak, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. That's the best they could do? And we were also told that the president is an imminent threat to the country and must be removed sooner rather than later. Heaven forbid letting the voters decide in November. I find it highly amusing every time I hear the Speaker Pelosi talk about the Republicans in the Senate being too biased, as if the Speaker and the Democrats are not. Now they think they can tell the Senate what to do. Which party is actually obstructing by not letting the process play out as it should? This whole impeachment farce is a waste of time and taxpayer money. And that again was written by Martha Yackel of Arthur. The next piece is written by Diana Visick of Urbana, called Vaccinations Make a Big Difference. Our shy and retiring cat, Rosa, had her teeth cleaned recently, a procedure that requires anesthesia. It went well, but as she was waking up, a vet tech put food and water in her cage. Rosa, not yet in her right mind, jumped and bit the tech, who had to go to convenient care for antibiotics. Our vet said that everyone in their office has been bitten at least once, and it's covered by workman's compensation. Doctors have to report any adverse human-animal interaction to animal control. As a result, I was notified that Rosa had to be quarantined for 10 days. Because her rabies vaccine was current, she was under house arrest rather than subjected to germs, stress, and expense in animal control lockup. As a strictly indoor cat, she noticed no change. After the quarantine, we had 6 days in which to take her back for yet another full exam, at no charge, to confirm she didn't have rabies and send a form to animal control. This exam had nothing to do with medicine, since her vaccine was up to date, but everything to do with liability. The entire protocol is specified by the state, not the county. The one useful thing that came out of this ordeal was a note put in Rosa's vet file suggesting she be housed in a bigger cage. I'm sharing this saga so other pet owners are aware of the process and can take preventive action. It's most important to vaccinate regularly. And that again was written by Diana Visick of Urbana. And in the history section, in area history, in 1920, Robert Perry, a member of the University of Illinois class of 1918 and one of the most popular students ever to attend the institution, was killed in a motorcycle race in Los Angeles. He was prominent in UI athletics and served in the aviation service during the war. In 1970, the first meeting of the Champaign City Council was to be gaveled to order earlier in the evening in an attempt to avoid a conflict with the University of Illinois Indiana basketball game that night. And in 2005, the University of Illinois Sportswell Center got a new home, but not the one it expected. The fitness, nutrition, and rehabilitation site was scheduled to move on January 1st into the former Illini Union Pool Hall, which moved its tables to the bowling alley that summer. However, unexpected construction and design delays caused Sportswell to temporarily locate at the McKinley Health Center, 1109 South Lincoln Avenue, before moving to the Illini Union in the fall. And we'll take a short break now and then return with the second half hour of the Friday, January 3rd, 2020 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.